I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, material scientist Anna Pozhaisky, and this episode I talked to historian Tom Rusbridge about leather. Tom did a PhD at the Universities of Birmingham and Sheffield, in which he researched 18th century leather craft. By the way, before we started recording, Tom told me about the various sort of innuendos he had to suffer throughout the duration of his PhD at the hands of his friends for doing a PhD about leather, which I'm telling you about now because this sort of salacious side of leather is alluded to later in our conversation. We had this chat over the internet during England's lockdown number two, despite actually being less than half a mile away from one another in our respective homes. But I started by asking Tom what we mean by the term leather.
When we use the term leather, we're not talking about any one particular material. We're using that as a catch-all to describe any one of a number of different materials that are bound together by a shared making process. And so leather at its kind of at its core, that is a skin that has been treated by a tanning process to have these very durable, water-resistant properties. With that in mind, it can include at one end really, really soft, delicate forms of material such as chamois or suede or pigskin leather, which are incredibly fine, incredibly soft. At the other end, we can have tanned ox hides and cow leather, those really kind of common but durable kind of tough materials used for boots and shoes in this period and the 18th century as well. And so leather is essentially a process, and that's what we need to start treating this material more and more as. It's leather is process. Leather isn't a single material. It's a family. It's a family of different materials, and the qualities of those different materials vary so much on the skin of the thing that has been tanned. So I've mentioned cow and goat, and those are quite common forms. I was really lucky in my research to handle all. I say I was lucky. Maybe you won't think I'm lucky when I say I've handled tanned human skin. I've handled human leather, and it's a fascinating material. It is so unbelievably similar to cow skin when you tan it. Who knew? I've also handled a tanned mouse skin, which is as small as you can imagine. Imagine one of those huge cow pelts, but in such a miniature format.
That's cute.
How many of them would you need for a jacket? but as I say, so what binds these all together is they all undergo a tanning process, and that's what makes leather.
So what is that tanning process?
So broadly speaking, you take the butchered hide of the animal, and I'm talking primarily about an early modern historical context.
Okay, cool.
Here.
Yep.
So I suppose that's where I'm coming from. That's where the journey starts, I suppose, in its history. That butchered hide is then soaked initially and then scraped. And what that scraping does is it removes any fur, any hair, any sinew, any adipose tissue, and it pairs that material down to the very kind of the base layer, which is a part of the skin called bucorium. That's then soaked again. And so for every process, there's kind of a washing and a rinse and repeat that happens. The hide is then soaked in tanning solutions of varying concentrations. It spends anywhere from 6 to 12 months in those different solutions, and then it comes out the other end. It's rinsed again, and then that's the point at which you can call it. That's the point at which you can call it a leather. What's going on in those tanning solutions? So in that kind of that soaking stage, what's happening is that the skins are being infused with naturally occurring substances that have those properties of being water resistant and being durable. To get that in there, so one of the most common of these is oak bark and oak bark resin. To get oak bark resin into a tanning solution, you basically burn it and grind it down to a powder, and then you mix that with water, and that becomes a tanning solution that the early moderns refer to as an ooze. And that is the technical term, the ooze. This is a process which undergoes an awful lot of experimentation in the period leading up to today. So what we're dealing with in a modern context, is chrome-based and mineral-based tanning far more commonly. And I can't really talk with a great deal of expertise about that process. But I think it would also be unfair to say that what I just described, which is vegetable-based tanning, is unpopular today, because actually it is popular and just still remain. And if you think about sort of the tanning pits when you're walking around Marrakesh or parts of India, these processes still happen and still create people really like, and that get used for very popular products.
What's the chemical requirement of a tanning substance? Because chromium sounds very, very different from something that comes out of oak.
Well, what's happening, and this is based on conversations I've had with conservators and actually, your compatriots, fellow material scientists. If you take a real zoom in on a hide, what you've got are a series of overlapping protein fibers of collagen. Those are bound by naturally occurring hydrogen bonds. And so as I understand it, you may want to edit this out if I'm committing a sort of material science faux pas, is that you are effectively stuffing the place where those hydrogen bonds were, which are naturally occurring. And so after the animal dies, rigor mortis sets in, and that's because that naturally occurring hydrogen isn't there anymore to enable protein fibers to rotate and sort of flex over the top of one another. Yeah. It's putting that material in that place. And so oak resin is one material that works. I'm not sure what the case is for the kind of more mineral materials, but thinking to my period in particular, 18th century scholars and tanners were incredibly investigative about the kinds of materials that could be used to do this thing. Mm. And so it started with, well, the process of experimentation starts really in earnest in the 16th century, but across the 17th century and into the 18th, you have Danish and English scholars experimenting with different materials. You've got people looking into different types of root. So there's a guy called Charles Valency, who investigates the materials in Ireland versus the rest of Europe. And this is a text called The Art of Tanning and Currying Leather. Now, The Art of Tanning and Currying Leather, published in 1770-ish in Dublin first, then has two reruns in London, has a unique preface, and that was written by Charles Valency, and that's about understanding why in Ireland tanning isn't taking off, and it's because they can't use their own natural materials, he says. So oak bark is fairly scarce in Ireland, and so there are a series of experiments using tormental root and an organic substance called cinquefoil, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, And then translate it to French work, which is a kind of tanning across Europe. Mm. So this is a kind of a really rubbish, lonely planet book, observing different types of tanning happening across the continent. But the basic point is that it needs to have some kind of oily particles within it that can then be burnt down and infused with this ooze. And so there are tanners in France using rotten citrus fruit that's reported. There is plum being used. There are the thorns of vine plants being used, only the thorns. So you've got to feel sorry for the person whose job it is to remove those from the plant. But yeah, the basic point is that across that period, what was once sort of perceived to be this kind of this hallowed material of oak bark undergoes a lot of revision. And that more materials work than they first thought.
Yeah. So I suppose from that we can learn that the tanners or the people that were working with leather were very experimental, I suppose, and they were, you know, they were interested in finding all sorts of different materials that they could use based on their kind of local area, I suppose. But what else can we learn about people from the leather that they worked with or the leather that they used?
I love that you use the word local there, because locality is a really key thing. And so when we look at tanning, I think we see a manufacturing process that is actually kind of deeply rooted, and that's a pun as well, in its local geography. You've got to access hides, and those hides typically come from a local butcher who is butchering animals from relatively local agriculture. The meat is being consumed locally, and then those hides have to be rinsed and scraped. And that's, of course, a local process. But if I wanted to really kind of hammer this point home, you're using local water in a physical place. Once that's happened, you go through this tanning process, steeping those hides in different concentrations of ooze, and those are oozes that are made using local materials. And so I think it's really interesting to look at leather and think about how, for a material, certainly in the early modern period, that was so common and was used for so many different types of object, and to think about, well, how very localized that material process was compared to, I mean, I remember growing up and reading Made in China on the underside of everything. Mm. I don't suppose that en masse we're getting much more local with our purchases today. So to think about how local that process is presents a very different vision of the world. I think it's a useful point of comparison for us. And then at the same time, it's that nature of the environment. And what I really do love about the story of leather is, when you look at this material, how very, very explicit its environmental connections are in the very nature of the thing. So I remember this was a brilliant thing. I used to be an official on fencing competitions, and I remember this was, so to orchestrate these competitions, by the national governing body, you know, they hired halls and spaces, and competitions happened all over the place. And as volunteers, we got, you know, kind of airlifted in to deliver a competition, and, you know, put up in a local B&B somewhere, do the competition, get the train home. Why do I say that? Because I remember once staying with a referee, so we, you know, shared a room, and he had a pair of really kind of wonderfully luxurious leather bags, which he was carrying all this stuff in. And I remember seeing these, you know, imagine the kind of Mary Poppins style, I forget what you'd call those kind of bags, but wonderful leather bags. And I remember him saying, they really stuck, and he said, oh, I really love these because, you know, you can tell that it's a real material. You can tell. And he was pointing, so there was this kind of almost like a birthmark along the side. They were quite light coloured bags. And he said, and you can see that's where the cow that was used to make this had a kind of, had a graze or had a cut or a blemish on its skin. As so where am I going with this? Where I'm going is that leather is very, very closely integrated with its environment in a way that modern materials and products today aren't. And I think it's quite telling for early modern consumers. Or is it quite telling for us? I think it's quite telling for us that early modern consumers were using so commonly a material that was a really, really clean representation of the environment in its very being. So you had a skin that was tanned, and you could see hair follicles on the surface. You could see the top grain. You knew where it came from. This is all public information. And there's a sense of pride that comes with that. And so 18th century authors write about the pride of a national economy and a product that is really the output of the environment and the labour of local people.
Mm.
And there's also a sense of, I think, responsibility. And there's that sense of being dutiful to the object. And so early moderns don't like waste, generally speaking. There's a sense of being responsible to the animal as well. And I think that's really important when we think about plastic consumption today and how throwaway things are, and how we're, you know, knowingly making products and using products that if they break, we've got a very, very slim chance of fixing, or at least fixing ourselves. So I think that's this potted example, a very, very long-winded answer to your question. What can this making process and what can leather tell us about people and societies? Well, it tells us that they had very different preoccupations than we do today.
But I think consumers today do still value materials like leather above their, you know, synthetic alternatives like, you know, polyurethane, these kind of shoes that look like leather but they're actually made of polymers. I mean, I know that I definitely would, if I was going to buy, like, right, for example, when last time I bought walking boots, I wanted to buy walking boots that would last me at least 10 years. So I went into the shop and I was aiming to buy their most expensive leather walking boots because I think there's a few things in life that you just get exactly what you pay for, and walking boots and sometimes waterproofs are examples of that. Like,
absolutely.
You know, things that you really rely on for durability and to last for a long time. And synthetic alternatives just don't compare. You know, they're not breathable. They're not as durable as leather, which is this really traditional material, but we still rely on it and value it.
Mm. I think people do. I think leather today has got, there are challenges. So number one, you've just touched on it, is cost. So leather is a relatively expensive material, and we do have to accept that, you know, that expense may make it a less accessible material. So in which case, I mean, there's a question about what more could be done to make it more accessible, I suppose. And then there's a question about that cost versus immediate need. So you said that you aim to sort of go and get the best walking boots that you could, the best leather walking boots that you could, and with the plan that they would last you 10 years. And I think that's an eminently sensible approach. Not now that I'm here congratulating you on your walking boot purchase. But that makes perfect sense. But plastic is generally cheaper and generally easier. And as a collective consumer mindset, we program towards kind of quick fixes versus more expensive upfront but longer durability. I don't know. And I often, you know, I've given a few say papers since the PhD. Actually, the question I'm getting more and more now, more so than I did when I started that project, which would be 2015, is about, well, you know, say, Tom, what do you think about leather today in terms of the ethics of animal consumption and veganism? And, you know, there's vegan leathers do exist. So there's pineapple skin and pineapple fibre is often used as the basis of vegan leathers. I've never handled it. Maybe that says something about me, but I've handled human leather, but not pineapple. And mushroom-based leathers exist as well, called muskin. I can't say that I've ever seen a vegan leather on the shelf in a shop, though. So I wonder, I don't know how accessible those materials are either. But yeah, I think there are people who still value it. And then I think there's also sort of the changing context by which this material can be valued. I'm not sure. It's an interesting one.
Yeah, it really is. I suppose there's a bit of a chicken and egg thing, isn't there? Because I think, is it true to say that still today leather is a kind of byproduct of the meat industry? Is it the same kind of product stream that comes through there?
That's right. As far as I know, yes. I mean, there are a few ways to get the hide off an animal without it being butchered at first. I think what we're doing is we are being more and more thrifty now. So I think one animal skin can go further than it did in an early modern context. So one common material is something called bonded leather. Have you come across this?
No, I don't think so.
So when I came, God, we've made the jokes about my thesis already. I mean, imagine when I had to use a term like bonded leather. but when you tan a hide, there's a swelling process that happens.
Okay.
So the materials in the tanning liquor interact with the innate materials within the skin, and it creates a swelling. So actually, it grows something like sort of 7 times its thickness while being tanned. How do you handle that? You slice the thing. So you literally imagine, as my screen, imagine it's sort of that thick. So you just slice it across that kind of cross surface to get it down to the size that it needs to be. Of course, that creates a kind of a rough surface, but then you buff it and you curry it or you polish it. And you know, plenty of shoe polish on something that's good as new from our school days taught us anything as well. But in doing that slicing process, you create loads and loads of tiny, tiny little leather fragments everywhere. Somebody sweeps all those things up, puts a very kind of puts a loose adhesive around them, and then presses them into a surface. And so if you've ever had a belt, or I mean, it's commonly belts, but sort of, I don't know, like a sort of a kind of a leather wristband, or maybe a strap on a bag, and it's, you know, you've bought it and it has said on it genuine leather, and you bought it in good faith that is genuine leather.
Yeah.
It is genuine leather. It's just thousands of pieces of tiny, tiny, tiny genuine leather bound together with glue. And then with an acrylic skin-like cover put over the top.
Interesting.
We're doing that now, and you know, that's making the kind of the volume of leather we're producing go further in a way that early moderns weren't. Why did I say that?
Well, we were talking about, I was asking you whether, you know, essentially my question was that I was going for was really, you know, is, we were talking about the ethics of the leather industry or the ethics of using leather. And I suppose I was thinking really if animals are being consumed in the meat industry anyway, and their hides are in general an offcast of that process, then isn't it better to use that material than to have it go to waste?
Yeah, and I would argue yes. I don't see what you're doing for the environment or the animal by discarding it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. I mean, I don't eat meat even, but I do buy leather products because it's just such a better material.
but it is, and that's the that's. I mean, there's a brilliant text. What's it called? Spectacle de la Nature, which is an 18th century text, Nicolas Antoine Puch, I think, and I can't remember who produced the English translation. But yeah, there's a wonderful passage in there, which is something along the lines of, you know, what can compare to the luster of ermine, and what can compare to the strength of ox, and what can compare to, I don't know, the softness of something else. You know, it's, this material works very well. And that's kind of, yeah, that's a kind of blunt truth, I think.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, totally, totally. I wonder if we can go back and talk about historical leather again. And it would be great to hear if there's sort of one or possibly two stories of objects from your studies that particularly embody what you think of as like the story of leather. It'd be great to hear one or two of those.
The warning note is that it's difficult to, for leather objects, it's quite difficult to have a sort of an object biography.
Okay.
And so what we're dealing with leather is often very functional objects that people didn't write about. And this is true. This isn't a leather exclusive problem. Material culture historians working with other types of material and other kind of categories of object have this as well. That said, I think it would be a real shame to try and tell a story of leather without looking at saddlery in some shape or form. And there is a really sort of classic, wonderful example sitting in the Clothworkers Centre, which is part of the Victoria and Albert Museum, which is, they've got it in their stores there. It's a 17th century object. It's a really kind of classic saddle design with yellow velvet sort of seat and embroidery on the top. It's a wonderful object. I don't think it's actually on display. Maybe this podcast could have a kind of political edge. Get it on display, B&A. Come on. But saddlery is a wonderful object because there are so few objects which have to work simultaneously equally well for two different types of living organism, right? And so saddles have to work really well for the horse that they're on the back of, because, you know, of course, I hate to think of a horse in pain. But at the same time, if you're an 18th century rider and the saddle doesn't fit the horse, it's going to damage the skin, it's going to cause the horse discomfort, it's going to put the horse out of action, that's got a financial implication for you, and then it's got to be comfortable for you, the rider, to use. And so there's this really kind of fascinating function of an object, which I don't think you see many examples of. And then that's all underpinned by the narrative around horse riding that exists in the 17th and 18th centuries, which is that you need to be really, really at one with the animal that you're riding. And so there's this idea that comes from an author in the period called Bourgelat, which is about the horse and the rider becoming the centauric being. And the idea is that move as one, there's this perfect kind of symbiosis of movement. There's this kind of shared goal, this shared intention, the shared attitude, everything about you and your horse have to be really in sync, right? And so you've got function and then you've got culture, really requiring that the two organisms work together. And that's mirrored in the design. And so a typical early modern saddle, you've got what's called the pads, and those are kind of stuffed cushions that are at the very base of the saddle. Then you've typically got the saddle tree, which is a hard wooden, sometimes it's got metal components, but generally it's wood, which is a hard wooden frame that sort of provides the kind of the rough basis. So that's generally a kind of a blunt instrument. And then you've got the panel at the top, which is the leather overpiece, which then the rider sits on. So it's generally three parts. And what's interesting, two things, I think. One, these objects are described as skin incredibly commonly. There's about a third of cases in newspaper adverts that I looked at. And this is in a sample, I think it was about 4,000. In about a third of cases, these are described as skin, which is much more common than shoes and much more common than breeches as well, which are other objects where skin is it's a sort of a key imperative. Second interesting thing is that the structure of these saddles closely mirrors early modern conceptions of how the skin was constructed as well. So you've got that exterior, which is the kind of the tough scarf skin. And the idea is that, you know, there's a turning point in the 18th century about how your body reflects your personality. And there's a whole other historiography around that. It's a really interesting point where those two ideas come together, the sort of the physical construction of the objects as reflecting the layers within human skin, and the idea that these objects are described as skin in the context of something that has to fuse physically and culturally two different organisms together. I think that what we're seeing is quite a sort of an explicit representation of a very conceptual idea happening without any real intent behind it. And so if you're going to pay attention to leather, you've really got to pay attention to saddles. It's, yeah, there's just so much to say about that object.
Mm.
And I'm sorry if that kind of that meandering has created something quite difficult for you to edit.
No, not at all. I'll probably just keep it all in. So I know that you said that you're not still researching this at the moment, but when you came to the conclusion of your PhD, were there any questions yet to be answered?
So I'm thinking about where my PhD sits. I do entertain the idea of going back to some historical research on the side.
Yeah.
So where my PhD was, I mean, there was a, in that kind of, I don't know, to historicize myself, that kind of post 2010, there was a really big wave of PhD students interested in materials and objects. And if somebody ever does a big history of British history PhDs in the 2010s, that would be one of the big trends, is people got more passionate about objects than they had done before.
Mm.
And what I think me and a lot of my peers at the time were trying to do was to sort of bring together cultural history, which I suppose in the grand scheme of things is relatively more modern than dealing with representations and dealing with cultural norms and how society worked with those, and a very old school form of sort of connoisseurial history. And if you imagine any of those wonderful old books on the shelf, I mean, I've got one which is sort of English dining room clocks 1660 to 1800. I mean, imagine who's got the time but the passion to just compile those kinds of books. Anyway, so there was a need to bring together those two different kind of types of history to show how objects have got quite powerful cultural underpinnings which shaped how people lived in these periods. My question was about the relationship between objects, consumers, and materials, and it was about testing that within one chronology and within one material type. And I chose leather because I felt it was particularly cross-class. You know, the poorest of the poor used leather as buckets and bellows and working tools, and the richest of the rich had fine leather upholstery and leather gilt wall panels. And I think that there is scope to test that question about how consumers related to materials through objects and to objects through materials. Yes, I think there's scope to test that question with a broader range of materials, with a broader range of organics. And I think that there are questions to be asked about testing that question, sort of considering 21st century consumption versus 18th century or earlier consumption as well.
Yeah, so interesting. When we were talking earlier about the kind of materials properties of leather, I suppose, being superlative to their polymer alternatives, I was thinking of other sort of naturally derived materials that follow, I think, a similar pattern. For example, wool, you know, by far the most superior fibre still, even though we have all these kind of modern textiles now, it's still... has the best combination of materials properties. Similarly, wood, carbon fibre, kind of similar now, but, you know, in terms of strength to weight ratio, wood is still, like, really incredible as a material. So, yeah, I think there would definitely be scope for an exploration of other similar similar materials, yeah.
Yes, that is fascinating, because I've seen... natural organic products, I think, will probably always be slightly more expensive than their synthetic counterparts. But there is it's quite interesting in some cases how these organic materials have become presented as the kind of the luxury alternative. And I've seen in sort of catalogues and in shops. So as I was saying, we're preparing to move, so we've been, you know, doing the IKEA run. But I've seen the woolen duvets as being this kind of incredibly luxurious thing.
Yeah.
You know, how can it be the case that the thing that we've had for the longest is the luxury item? Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, so true. I was I've been reading a bit about wool for the book that I've just written. In fact, there's a whole chapter on it. And apparently there was, you know, wool has been an amazing material throughout the majority of human history. And then there was this big crisis in the early 20th century when suddenly, you know, synthetic polymers came along and you could make items of clothing for so much cheaper than their wool alternatives. So there was this big kind of wool demand crash, and it was like almost the end of wool because plastics was seen as so much cheaper. And so they had to invent to make wool as competitive as plastics again, they had to get rid of wool's main drawback, which was like the felting and the, you know, woolly jumpers going bobbly, and you couldn't put them in the washing machine, which was like a big thing now for the middle classes to have washing machines at home and stuff. So they invented superwash wool in I think the 60s, possibly slightly later, which essentially like smoothed down all of those little scales that you get on hair, so that it wouldn't then mat up in the washing machine, and that finally made wool like competitive again. So it's interesting that sometimes synthetics can push these natural materials to being even better with like slightly different processes, and yeah, I'm sure they will continue to change as we change as a society as well.
That's fast. I had no idea about that about wool. Well, I mean, Yeah.
Yeah. Well, likewise. Yeah. So if people have enjoyed hearing from you and want to kind of learn more about historical leathers, is there anywhere that you can direct them, either a book or maybe a museum or your own writings, so they can find out more?
So, well, in terms of my own writings, there's a smattering of blogs. So if you Google me plus leather, and my thesis will be available out of embargo in January.
Nice.
By the University of Birmingham. So that's there.
For a really deep dive.
But I would I'd heartily recommend the National Leather Collection.
Oh, cool. I've not heard of that.
It's a wonderful museum in Northampton. Uh-huh. They're actually based in the Grosvenor Square shopping centre, opposite Eurochange. You have to go up a few flights of stairs. But they've got a very informative website as well.
Cool.
Wonderful people. So yeah, National Leather Collection. And actually that National Leather Collection, I mean, it's got that branding now. Prior to that, it's been the British Leather Collection and the International Museum of Leathercraft. It's had a few iterations over the years.
Cool.
But it's ultimately the kind of the fruits of the labour of a guy called John Waldron. And I think Clive Spears was the other guy. But John Waldron certainly wrote volumes and volumes and volumes on leather, all very accessible. They're quite old texts now. I think that the earliest of those is 1942-ish.
Okay. Yeah.
So, a mid-war period text. But nevertheless, they're, you know, interesting.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
I mean, absolute pleasure. I mean, really, I've enjoyed this a lot. No, very different sort of Monday, but a very happy one.
Thanks. So that was the awesome Tom Rusbridge. Thanks so much to him for taking the time to come on the podcast. That's all for this week. As always, I'd be super grateful if you're able to take the time to like and subscribe or recommend the podcast to a friend. If you feel like giving a one-time donation to help support the costs of running the podcast, you can do so at supporter.acast.com/handmade. Thanks so, so much to those who have already taken the time to do that. If you've got any material questions you'd like answered, then do get in touch. We're at Real Talk, that's R-I-A-L Talk, on Twitter, and on Instagram at Handmade Pod. You can get in touch on email at realtalkpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks as always to Dave Shepherd for our marvellous cover art and to Alex Lathbridge for the music mix. So until next time, thanks as always for listening, and I'll look forward to seeing you next time on Handmade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.